Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unexplained and unsettling radical change in U.S. foreign policy the Trump administration has brought about, where close allies are punished and insulted while adversaries like Russia are praised and dictators, despots, murderers and kleptocrats in Saudi Arabia, the Philippines and Turkey are rewarded. Thomas Berger, professor of international relations at Boston University who specializes in German politics and political culture, joins us to discuss the puzzling nature of Trump's about-face in U.S. relations, with close allies like Germany, Australia, and South Korea gratuitously insulted while thugs and dictators are praised. We'll examine the embarrassing optics of a preening president pushing aside the leader of a small European country, and the disgust across Europe at Trump's boorish behavior during the NATO summit and the G7 meeting, as well as the extent to which the September elections in Germany will be all about running against Trump. Then we will speak with Joan Williams, distinguished professor of law at the University of California Hastings College of Law, who joins us to discuss her new book, White Working Class: Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. We'll look into why populist movements around the world are gaining traction among the white working class and how much of the elite's analysis of the white working class is misguided and rooted in class cluelessness. Then finally, Diane Standett, the executive vice president of the Center for Responsible Lending, joins us to examine the stealth move on the part of House Republicans who slipped in a free pass to payday lenders and car title loan sharks in the Financial Choice Act pushed by the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Texas Republican Jeb Hensarling. He happens to be the largest individual recipient of money from the payday lenders and title loan bottom feeders that charge up to 400% interest on predatory loans and hold onto car titles, charging exorbitant interest rates which, if you fall behind in payments, means you lose your transportation to work. And joining us now is Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government and political culture. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Berger.
Pleasure to be talking with you.
Well, thank you, Thomas. And I'm trying to get an understanding here of the extraordinary, almost incomprehensible foreign policy of the Trump administration, where Donald Trump goes out of his way to insult America's longest and most enduring allies, whether it's hanging up on the Australian Prime Minister, insulting Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, both in the White House and during last week's NATO summit in Brussels, and then later in Sicily at the G7 meeting. And at the same time, of course, he just absolutely worships Putin. Putin can do no wrong, even though he's trying to undermine the West and Western Europe. And he praises this murderous thug in the Philippines. He praises this egomaniacal, anti-democratic, authoritarian leader in Turkey who's jailing just about everybody he can get his hands on. He's nice to him. He insults the South Koreans, our important allies, whose capital city, Seoul, could be obliterated at any moment by the North Koreans. This is just incomprehensible. Have you figured it out? What's going on here? What is the subtext? Why would an American president be trying to destroy America's, the foundation of American national security?
Well, it's obviously a pretty provocative way in which you're phrasing it, but there certainly is, it's a very difficult to try to figure out what is the method to Trump's madness. I mean, any individual case, you can make a case for reaching out, for example, to the Saudis, isolating Iran, looking for ways to work more closely, reset the relationship. Virtually every American presidency since 2000 has been trying to restart relations with Russia. But put all together, it's very hard to make sense out of what's going on. And it is having a very corrosive and damaging effect in our relations with some of our oldest traditional allies, notably in Europe.
Well, Chancellor Merkel made it pretty clear that She said the other day, the times when we can completely rely on others are, to an extent, over. And, of course, it looks as though Trump has responded to Angela Merkel's comments just on Tuesday, May the 30th, at 3:40 a.m., I might add. Donald Trump tweets out, "We have a massive in caps trade deficit with Germany, plus they pay far less in caps than they should on NATO and military. Very bad for US. This will change." So without getting into the details of how inaccurate that statement is, obviously he's doubling down. Do you think it's in response to Angela Merkel's comments?
Well, undoubtedly it is. I mean, Trump has a pattern of doubling down whenever somebody defies him. And this is just fits further into that pattern. Now, the quick question, of course, that one has to ask is, what are the concrete consequences of this particular fight? We've had many fights in the alliance before. You may remember from 2003, we had the old Europe versus the new Europe and the crisis over Iraq. Going back in the 1990s, the United States was not eager to get involved in the former Yugoslavia. We left it to the Europeans, and they didn't do a terribly good job dealing with Milosevic and Karadzic. And if you go even further back, I mean, you know, during the Cold War, it was we constantly had seesawing relations with our European allies, including the Germans. So to some extent, this is a continuation of older patterns. And each time that we've had these crises in the past, we have been able to reestablish relations. It's been both in our interests and in the interests of our allies, including our European allies, to not let relations deteriorate too far. Will this time be different, I guess, is the sort of question that one has to ask. Well, in some ways, the basic structural, I mean, beyond the really, and I think here, you know, you really do have to look at the personalities involved, but beyond the sort of these personalities, are there sort of structural conditions, are there sort of fundamental things, the, you know, tectonic plates of international politics, have they shifted in such a way that we're really going to have a rupture this time? It's too early to tell, of course, but on this score, I think that the Europeans, including the Germans, are not ready to give up on us that quickly. Merkel, now one of the things one has to remember is when Merkel made her comment about saying Europe must now take its fate into its own hands. We cannot rely on others. We have to understand also that she is, first of all, and I think on a personal level, there is some reaction to the sort of rather rude behavior that Trump engaged in, pushing aside, for example, the Prime Minister of Montenegro in the photo shoot at the Brussels meeting. So I think there's a personal reaction. But beyond that, we also have to understand that right now there is an election campaign getting underway in Germany. In the fall of this year, we're going to have federal elections in Germany. And this issue, this question of how to shape Germany's and Europe's relationship to the United States under Donald Trump, is moving now very quickly to the center stage. And the different political parties, there's a kind of universal consensus, as far as I can see, looking at the German press, watching the German media, there's a kind of universal consensus that Trump's behavior goes beyond the pale, and that if somebody has to stand up to him. This is, you know, he's treating NATO like some kind of protection racket. Somebody called the German newspaper the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is the sort of standard bearer of conservatism in Germany, and usually a traditionally pro-Atlantic, pro-American newspaper, described Donald Trump as Don Trump, you know, sort of like an American godfather coming down and saying, pay up your dues or else. So, you know, there's that kind of political dynamic which is taking hold right now in Germany, and Merkel is not going to let her opponents on the left outflank her on this issue. But at the same time, if you listen carefully to both the sort of things which people in the German foreign ministry and defense ministry, including and also people inside of Merkel's own government, within her government office, what they call the Kanzleramt, so the German equivalent of the White House, they are at the same time sort of pointing out that in the future, while we have a problem with this particular presidency, we will need to work with the United States. And the reason for that is because, quite simply, what the Europeans still cannot do without us, especially in the field of security policy. While one could say conceivably, you know, the European countries could come together and create, for example, their own military force, including an atomic deterrent, a nuclear weapon deterrent. In practice, this would be enormously difficult. It would be difficult politically, it would be expensive, and it would create enormous tensions internationally. So for this reason, the Europeans, including and the Germans, are not yet ready to give up on this relationship, this alliance. But in the shorter run, in the next few months, next few years, we're going to have a very difficult transatlantic relationship.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations, and comparative government and political culture. He's the author of War, Guilt, and World Politics After World War II, and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. And you mentioned the opposition. Of course, this is a coalition government where Angela Merkel is in coalition with the center-left Social Democrats who are running against her, in effect. And their leader, Martin Schulz, told reporters that Trump was, quote, the destroyer of all Western values. And then the foreign minister, who also comes from the same party, the Social Democrats, Foreign Minister Sigmar Gabriel, also was even more critical, quoting him, "Anyone who accelerates climate change by weakening environmental protection, who sells more weapons in conflict zones, and who does not want to politically resolve religious conflicts is putting peace in Europe at risk. The short-sighted policy of the American government is against the interests of the European Union." So you can see in those statements that Angela Merkel has to, I mean, in other words, this September election in Germany, they're going to be all running against Trump.
Yes, there's no doubt about it. I mean, there is, just on every kind of central issue, be it trade, be it the environment, be it sort of national security, there are now going to be very sharp differences drawn between the way in which interests in Europe are defined as opposed to the interests of the United States. And it's going to be ugly, quite frankly, Ian. It's not going to be a very happy picture. And it's not only Germany. I mean, these attitudes are widely shared in much of the European continent. Britain is a little bit different. I think on the right end of the political spectrum, we have, you know, the people who support Brexit, we have a somewhat different picture. But in France, in Holland, in Italy, I think that there is a, by and large, among the major political parties, a kind of consensus which the United States is now really rupturing with Europe on a whole broad range of different issues. Now, what will that mean concretely? What can the Europeans do? I don't think they're going to give up NATO. They're not going to, impose economic sanctions on the United States. That's, impossible. But I do think it means that the Europeans will be going their own way in a broad range of issues, beginning with climate change. They're going to push forward the Paris Accord, which is seeking to reduce greenhouse gases. They're going to try to forge ahead on that without the United States. They may look for ways of reaching out to other economies, especially in East Asia, reaching out to China, reaching out to India, reaching out to Japan, Korea, and in effect create alternative free trade or enhanced trade agreements, which won't include the United States. And in general, we're going to see, a kind of isolation of the United States in a number of different diplomatic areas.
Well, we all saw the extraordinary video of Trump in this boorish way, elbowing aside Dusko Markovic, the Prime Minister of Montenegro, which is the country that's just entering the EU. It's like, the country that's about to enter gets elbowed out of the way. But not only does he elbow this guy out of the way, he steps in front and then he puffs his chest up like some sort of peacock. It was embarrassing. It was childish. You know, I believe now that the Brits would never have voted Brexit in the current context. This is before Trump came in. This is when all of that populism was on the boil. But they must be having buyer's remorse. I mean, people in the United States are having buyer's remorse, for God's sake. He's at 37% and plunging. And, it's possible that he and his family are going to end up in jail. So it's so outrageous.
Well, it's going to be, I do not claim to be have any particular expertise in terms of U.S. politics. But, beyond what any other well-educated and informed citizen has. But, it is quite clear that it's going to be difficult, based on the evidence that is available to us so far, to find a crime with which to charge at least Trump and his most immediate circle. We'll see about Jared Kushner. But, even a liberal like Dershowitz points out, what is the statute that under which one could charge them? And, of course, 37%, 39%, and you take a look at the sort of average of different polls of people still support the Trump administration, and that 39% is overwhelmingly in the Republican Party. And so they represent, therefore, 60, 70% of the Republican base. And since the Republicans control the House and the Senate, through which any kind of impeachment process would have to take would have to go, Trump's position in terms of removing Trump from office is very unlikely. And I think quite a few. I've spoken to some of the people who are involved with European and East Asian diplomats, and they're all aware of this. And they are going on the assumption that at least for a couple of years, possibly through this term at least, we're going to have a Trump administration. They're going to have to work with that. And so I think if looking at the German newspapers, looking at the Japanese newspapers, the assumption is that they're going to have to learn to deal with this situation for now. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, a reality that not only we in the United States, but also people abroad have to come to terms with. Now, that may change. We have new revelations, new developments, but that seems like a very plausible scenario to a lot of people. And means that they're going to have to do their foreign policy, based upon such an expectation.
Well, absolutely. And the president is, to this extent, above the law, except he can be impeached, and that's more of a political than a legal process. But it does seem now that General Flynn has actually made a deal with the FBI. That's why he turned down the deal with the, or his lawyers did turn down the deals with the Senate Intelligence Committee in terms of their subpoenas. So it seems that there is a case being made and that Flynn is squealing on the others. And frankly, the only explanation, at least one of the main explanations, is glaring us in the face for this insane foreign policy of insulting your closest allies, tearing up your alliances, not even wanting to acknowledge Article 5 of the NATO treaty when the Europeans came to the US's rescue after 9/11 and fought beside them in Afghanistan. The only rational explanation, at least that I can come up with, for this behavior on the part of Trump's is that somehow he's got some secret relationship with Putin, who's the main beneficiary of tearing up and destroying America's security arrangements. So that seems to be inescapable. But just let's finish up in the last couple of minutes here with some of the factual stuff here rather than speculate. The trade deficit with the US and Germany is $67.8 billion, and Trump again tweeted about that today. But Germany also in last year bought $80.4 billion of US products. Most of the, he talks about the BMW. For some reason or other, Trump hates BMW. I mean, for God's sake, they've got factories here in the United States. Is Trump prepared to put hundreds of thousands of Americans out of work down in those right-to-work southern states?
Well, I rather doubt it. And I think that, when push comes to shove, there is going to be, there's more bluster than bite involved here. Germans and Europeans are major investors in the American economy. As you pointed out, hundreds of thousands of American jobs are connected to trade with Europe. German and Europeans have large investments in the United States, and really sort of an economic divorce would be simply catastrophic. And I think, beyond Trump, we have to also take a look at the broader White House, and there are are lots of people who have a much closer to a traditional understanding of American foreign policy and American national interests, beginning with General Mattis as the Secretary of State, Steve Mnuchin in Treasury, Rex Tillerson, and all of them, I think, are much more internationalist, much more have instincts which are much more in line with traditional American foreign policy. And I think that sets quite sharp limits on what this White House is able to do. But these atmospherics and these kinds of initiatives that Trump has undertaken are having an effect. And, of course, the key issue, of course, is how will Trump act in the context of a real crisis, for example, in the on the Korean Peninsula, or in the European context, where we have to be especially careful, is the Baltic states. If we have a major military conflict which breaks out in those areas, Trump, as commander-in-chief, has a great deal of latitude to move things in one direction or another. And it's, I think, in those moments that people who think a lot about these issues, that kind of scenario, that people really have a lot of fears and concerns.
Right. This infantile, egotistical, insecure blowhard has the nuclear codes. But just aside from that, just in the last second here, I wanted to get at your sense, because you're both an expert on German politics and Japanese politics. Why is it that Trump has a good relationship with Abe, the Japanese leader? Is it because he has business deals and because he was the first guy to come to Trump Tower and Abe flattered Trump? Is that what it comes down to, if you flatter this insecure ego?
Well, I think that there's two things. I mean, I do think that there is the fact that the Japanese very quickly and successfully managed to reach out to Trump already before he got into the White House, right after his victory in November last year. And Trump, Abe is very skillful. He's good at interpersonal relationships. And so the two men have managed to, you know, playing golf together, talking together, have established a positive relationship. But I think beyond that, there is also the fact that at least on the issue of Russia, and this reinforces some of your suspicions, but on the issue of Russia, Japan and the United States, albeit for different reasons, do have a certain coincidence of interest. The Japanese are less concerned about Crimea, less concerned about the Ukraine than, let's say, the Europeans, and certainly than Angela Merkel is. And they are interested in reaching out to Russia in order to weaken relations between China and and Russia. I mean, the primary concern for Japanese policymakers is how to deal with this gigantic, on and off, occasionally, you know, quite hostile, certainly assertive superpower in their own backyard. And China and Russia have a very close strategic relationship. Lots of military technology is being supplied by Russia to the People's Republic, energy, economic ties. And so the Japanese want to be able to weaken that relationship, if possible, reach out to the Russians as a balance against the People's Republic of China. Also, Abe is very concerned about North Korea, and you know, Trump shares that point of view. So there is a coincidence, a limited coincidence, but a very real coincidence in strategic views between Japan and the United States. And therefore, we haven't seen the same kind of disunity, the same kind of tensions and frictions between Tokyo and Washington that we've seen between Washington and our European allies, especially in Berlin.
Well, Thomas Berger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Berger, who's a professor of international relations at Boston University, who specializes in German and Japanese politics, international relations and comparative government and political culture. He's the author of War Guilt and World Politics After World War II and Cultures of Anti-Militarism, National Security in Germany and Japan. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the author of the new book, White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America.